Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Thank you very much for the warm reception. While I'm the editor of the book, the publisher is Oliver Chin, who's back in the corner. So I want to introduce you to someone who's very brave to take on this book. There aren't very many of them. His company, iMedium, is rather new, and I'm very excited to be associated with it. Basically, what I wanted to do was to put the book in context a little bit. I've known Barb for a long time, many, many years. I don't know, maybe 15, maybe 14, something like that. And Larry, about a little longer than that. And every year, Barb and I would sort of discuss her life and career. And it sort of gathered steam in the last few years. And she couldn't quite decide which project she should do. And I said, just do the Burning Man book, because it had consumed her whole life, really. So I introduced her to Oliver and magic. So he asked me to be an editor in the project. But what we wanted to do was something a little different. We didn't want to just put a compilation of photos together. We really wanted to create a book that created an experience, because Burning Man really is an experience. And so the photographs, as you can see in the book, are from day to night. But if you spend a lot of time with those photos from the beginning to end, you'll see that there's some rhythms to the book. There are some images that relate to each other. And then, most importantly, I really tried to use the title, Desert to Dream, which I feel is an active title, in other words, Desert to Dream, to really truly express the idea of why Burning Man is so powerful for everybody, which is the fact that it's a gigantic Dali-esque canvas on the playa. And from that, everybody transforms themselves into something they imagine, something they've always wanted to be, something they just invent at that moment. So it is a place to dream. And if you look on the book, I tried to put some of the photos on the left so that it's more deserty or more realistic or gritty or more realistic. And then on the right often is the transformation, the reimagining, the investigation of that person's heart. So when you go through the book, think about how the pages, when they're open, how they relate to each other, and sometimes how five or six of the pages relate to each other. And then you'll see my creative input into the book, and that will make me very happy. But anyway, I now want to introduce Larry, who will provide his usual charming repartee, and then also provide some context, for Burning Man itself. Just introduce him. And he's in the back of the room. You can't miss the hat. There he is. Larry, what? She's right here. Larry has guided Burning Man's progress as executive director since its founding. In 1986, Larry went to Baker Beach with a few friends to burn an 8-foot-tall wooden man for summer solstice. And this year, nearly 35,000, maybe 40,000 people will join him for the event in the desert. He also co-curates the annual art theme and collaborates with artists yearly to design Black Rock City. Larry Harvey has made Burning Man into what it is today, an experiment and temporary community dedicated to radical self-expression and self-reliance. That's Larry has used that for many, many years as a way to express that, inviting its citizens to express themselves in ways that are often a dramatic departure from their daily lives. And with that, I will turn it over to Larry.
I'm inclined to turn it over to Barb, since this is her art. Having looked at this book as it was created and seen the final product, if you don't mind me speaking for you a little.
Fire away.
Well, there are two themes in it that you'll recognize. One is the thesis that, that photography is performance. And anyone who understands art as photography knows that. But at Burning Man, too often, the ill-informed will decry the poor photographers because they're not participating. And they have the idea that everyone must be participating. Well, the photographer is participating. It's just you have to have a little patience with the process, because it's not as bad as writing, maybe, but it's right up there with postponed satisfaction. Indeed, the photographer is a great large part of the art is in seizing the instant. And indeed, Burning Man is very much about spontaneity. And her second theme, which gladdens my heart, is that she not only photographed the pictures that are in the book, but she wrote it. And then she invited, among others, Les Blank, Lawrence Ferlin Getty, who had written a poem quite on his own that mentions Burning Man in a particularly apposite way. And this sustains the thesis that there is an arc of continuity between bohemian scenes of the past and what's happening in Burning Man, with Burning Man, because I think, like we do, I'm sure that I think most of you are probably San Franciscans, and of all cities in America, that there's not one that gives more latitude to creative freedom. Or as I once said to an entrepreneur who'd come here from L.A. and somehow lost all of his money in ill-founded schemes, I said, "It's all right. People, creative people, come here to find themselves and go broke." But what they gain very often are visions that make our city distinctive. If you think about it for a moment, our population is really very modest. It's not quantity; it's quality of people that come here, and very often in search of a vision. And that's happened in waves from the gold rush days, when the miners grabbed their picks and marched down Market Street on a whim. That stamped indelibly the character of San Francisco as it is. And it's what many of us particularly value about it, all the way through to several waves of creativity, artistic achievement, that stamp San Francisco as an international city. You take that away from San Francisco, and we're Sacramento West, almost. I'm overstating it. But it is what we all ought to be very proud of, and Barb is a perfect example of that.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming out tonight.
I actually wouldn't like to introduce Barb because I didn't do it before. So just quickly, to give you some background, Barb is a photographer and multimedia artist currently residing in San Francisco. She studied photography for a semester at Saatchi in Florence. In 1987, she won first place in Baltimore Sun Magazine's annual photo contest, and her work became a search for the everyday poetic moments. She was chief photographer for Hardwired's book Burning Man, curator of Art of Burning Man at Photo SF, and author of this book. A retrospective of her work was also shown at the International Photo Festival in Belgium's Knock Heist. Please welcome Barb Trapp.
Good evening, and thanks for coming out tonight. I think I already said that once, so I'll say it again. Well, how many of you here were last night for the governor? Anyone? Well, it's a tough act to follow. So here we go. Well, I'm going to begin with the beginning of the foreword written by Larry. Imagine a completely abstract space, a world without context, a place that is no place at all apart from what you bring to it. Anyone may enter this arena, Distinctions of race, class, age, and wealth are irrelevant here. Participants are free to reinvent their own identities. Reality is what you make it on this ultimate frontier. It is a world wherein the boundary that divides the inner from the outer disappears. The place is Northern Nevada's Black Rock Desert, the largest flat expanse of land in North America. The event is Burning Man. So let's go back to 1994. I just moved here from Baltimore, and it was a rough beginning, not really knowing anyone out here. A good friend came out to visit me in early August, and we went to Lake Tahoe, picked up this Moon Guide Publications to Nevada that mentioned this Black Rock Desert with prehistoric, dried and crackled lake bed, and natural hot springs, and the nearby town of Gerlach, where Bruno's homemade ravioli was worth a 2 hours drive north of Reno. So there we were. Well, returning to San Francisco, I picked up a flyer for Burning Man, happening in the same Black Rock Desert with all these cool-sounding things going on. Well, I was looking for a new project, and I thought, this could be it. So I went out there 3 weeks later and subsequently for the following 9 years. And what we have here is late in the afternoon under a storm-filled sky. The shadow of the man stretched out on the playa next to a speaker box. And in the distance is a trail of dust being kicked up by a car. So here's an example of how the book's laid out. It's mostly done in diptychs, so you have a photo on the left page and a photo on the right page. The one on the left I call Free Cloud in honor of Alfred Stieglitz, who liked to photograph clouds because they were tax-free and available to everyone. What did he claim? It wasn't the subject photograph that mattered. It was the photographer who made it interesting, something like that. On the right is Mudman, who's covered with mud from the nearby hot springs. Notice how much he resembles the dried and crackled surface of the playa. I call this Twin Peaks. Again, notice how the tentscape in the shapes and forms of the tentscape in the foreground and Trigo Peak in the distance mimic and echo each other. So I'd say about a third of the book is in black and white and two-thirds is in color. Well, it's not uncommon to see surreal scenes such as this at Burning Man. And this is a World War II-style submarine that appears to surface on the playa. Well, in prehistoric times, Black Rock Desert was part of the Great Inland Sea, and the playa was called Lake Lahontan. The circular image here is the result of the fisheye lens that I used, and this is called Flying Colors. Sagrada Familia. Anyone recognize this as from the lead image that for Wired magazine's cover story on Burning Man in 96? That began with introducing the new American holiday. So good. It still holds 10 years later. That's good to know. So writer Bruce Sterling, he described Black Rock City as a physical manifestation of the internet, with each camp like a website with different ways of luring you in. These space bugs, pair of space bugs, were converted from old VW Beetles by Carl Descartes, and not only are they used for getting around Black Rock City, but also for driving on the highway. He Yes, there is a Spock theme camp out there. And they do publish a Pig Dog, which is a daily newsletter with the motto, "Rock out with your Spock out." Yes. Well, and he contributed to the book as well, and actually a passage from his autobiography, "I Am Not Spock." So I'll read you a little bit here from that. "There is a suspicion that Spock has knowledge which could be very helpful to a troubled humanity. I have been contacted by metaphysical organizations. One group told me that I had been chosen for the Spock role because I was a carrier of ideas, concepts of which I myself might not be aware, that my real function in the series was to prepare mankind for the future and to relieve public tensions about phenomena which were bound to come. This particular group communed in the Nevada desert and had personal and direct contact with extraterrestrials, who visited them and took members of the group on short rides on their spacecraft. They could reveal themselves to me, they said, because I would be capable of accepting and understanding. However, they felt the public would be hostile and needed further education through roles like mine." This is a gigantic statue of a seated bibliophile made of discarded books and rebar by Dana Albany and Flash Hopkins. Body of Knowledge, it's called.
The leaves of the book that are flapping in the wind were intended to be its voice box.
Ah, there we go. And that book there, I think it's on the Panama Canal or something. Another example of a diptych like it is in the book. And on the right is Pepe Ozan's tower, 1997 Tower of Ishtar. And Pepe has produced and directed operas for a number of years at Burning Man, and each one reflected uniquely on that year's theme, featuring one or more towers surrounded by dancers, singers, fire eaters, punks, nymphs, magicians, and other celebrants. And it's made of mud, chicken wire, and rebar. The one on the left is David Best's 2002 Temple of Joy, made of scrap wood. And like Pepe's series of operas, David has also created a series of temples over a number of years where burners would go to meditate, hang out, pay tribute, pray, wish, hug, or just merely admire the magnificent edifice.
Can I have one, too?
Sure.
David is a remarkable personality, and he managed over several years to cast a spell over Black Rock City. First of all, the interesting thing about much of the art at Burning Man is that as simply being audience to it, you're apt to be recruited to help make it, and David would wait until a sufficient number of people had gathered around. He'd do another thing. He'd go out, and he would tell them. He would tell them that this was dedicated to those all those who had died, all those that people had lost. And at the very center of the temple, and this was the motivating force behind his first temple. A friend had died, and he ended up dedicating the center of every temple to the suicides. And people would cram this structure with an amazing array of artifacts, and they wrote all over it. And when we installed a like temple, on Hayes Green in San Francisco, not at this scale, but of this quality, it took us a while to explain to the police that it was okay that people wrote on it. It wasn't vandalism, it was participation. And he would, in speaking to them, he'd say, this hand is to suicide. He invented instant ritual in a simple action. No one was self-conscious about it. It didn't feel contrived. He'd say, this is to suicide. That died alone without relief or sorrow. And so put that on your heart. And this is the baby that died innocent of any sin at birth. And this hand, now put your hands together, and this hand will help the other hand. And it just stunned them. And this is in the middle of this riotous celebration, you know. But within a few yards of it, uniformly over the years, a hush just descends on thousands of people as they draw near it. So it says we were very glad to have put something up in the city. Our foundation's at the Black Rock Arts Foundation. And part of what we're about is reclaiming the social function of art, the way it can connect people, the way it can create community, the way it can integrate into civic settings, and thus affect the way all of us live together. This is interactive art, and it's also touched with a very authentic sense of what is and should be sacred.
So on the left here, we have a couple engaging in spontaneous performance atop Zachary Coffin's spinning boulder. And then on the right is Ray Serino's Water Woman that he created to launch the Age of Aquarius and also to serve as an antidote to the creative frenetic energy of Burning Man. Well, another fisheye shot, and the Burning Man statue here looks like a wishbone due to the angle and curvature of the lens. See, that's the lens right there. It's a big one. This is a 2003 aerial shot over Black Rock, some of Black Rock City. And it's laid out kind of like in a horseshoe with concentric streets bearing names pertaining to the theme that year, crisscrossed with streets corresponding to hours of the clock. And I guess my first year in 94, there were about 1,500 people, and by 2003, I guess the count was about, 30,000?
Maybe a little less, but it grew.
Yeah. This is a shot on an infrared film. It's a hailstorm approaching camp. And I guess we could say nature is definitely in the house. Where heaven and earth meet. This was actually shot on TechPan film, which was military satellite film with very fine grain and sharp. And very thin film base, so it could be rolled up very tightly and dropped from parachutes, something like that. I guess what I kind of let Edgar Allan Poe speak for this one, so I'm going to read you a part here from A Dream Within a Dream. I stand amid the roar of a surf-tormented shore, and I hold within my hand grains of the golden sand. How few, yet how they creep through my fingers to the deep. While I weep, O God, can I not grasp them with a tighter clasp? O God, can I not save one from the pitiless wave? Is all that we see or seem but a dream within a dream? So you can take the girl out of Baltimore, but you can't do the reverse. So a bunch of pianos were burned in an Oakland warehouse fire. And 1 year, Steve Hecht hauled them out to the playa and created a sound sculpture with drumsticks that were available to burners who could strum the strings of the piano with the drumsticks. So when a bunch of people were doing it all at once, it was created quite a cacophony of noise. Sisters Kitty and Dana from the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence, a group of Bay Area performance artists who have been dressing as nuns in drag since the late 70s. Cruising the playa here in their decorated golf cart. And these are ravers at Camp Oz, still at it the next morning. Reporters gather here from around the world in Black Rock City's press room, run by Maid Marion Goodell and staff. And this is Camera Van by Harrod Blank, covered with over 2,000 cameras, and some of them actually work by the shutter buttons wired to the dashboard. His father, filmmaker Les Blank, wrote the introduction to the book, and I'll read you a paragraph from that. It was so hot when I arrived at midday, I became immediately exhausted and spent the rest of the day in shock, hiding from the sun beneath a jerry-rigged tarp attached to the side of my car and peeking out at people passing by in a parade of surrealistic proportions. There was a nude Jesus nailed to the cross with wheels that made its way across the playa, followed by an entire living room on wheels loaded with laughing, cheering sybarites guzzling beer and daiquiris to loud disco bolting from the generators, from the vehicle's generator-powered killer amp. Plenty of people were just walking, their costumes and colorfully painted bodies becoming more glowingly rich in color and magic as the day's heat gradually receded and faded into the magic hour before dusk and darkness. Well, notice how the cameraman in the middle here has become a part of the tableau that I captured on film. This is a front yard in Black Rock City with the storm approaching. And due to the volcanic nature of Black Rock Desert, there are some natural hot spring formations. So here we have Club Mud instead of Club Med. Well, now it's access is restricted during the event because there are just too many people. Well, this was taken back in 95. And this is Gigsville, and what you see here is a centerpiece for a collection of theme camps who stay in touch all year round, like lots of theme camps do now, and create activities outside of just what goes on for a week at Burning Man in the desert. And at night, there's a bonfire in the car where the seats used to be to stay warm. Burning Man is the celebration of art and life that comes together in the spirit of spontaneous creativity and performance. Or, well, how is this one? Representing nothing, the man becomes tabula rasa. Any meaning may be projected onto him. And this is Twilight. These statuettes were part of an installation by Steve Yonkman. Bicycles are the most common means for getting around Black Rock City. We could invoke Walt Whitman here. I sing the body electric. And this was a nebulous entity, a black-lit suspended window installation by Dana Albany that was part of the Burning Man exhibit at the San Francisco Arts Commission in 98. And let's see. These figures here are me twirling around during a long exposure, and the camera was on a tripod. Firefly. And this is a scene from the 96 opera, and the towers have just been ignited. So it used to be the opera burn was Saturday night and the man burned Sunday night. Now the man burns Saturday night and the temple burns Sunday night. Something like that. This is a group of dancers spinning fire around the man before he goes kaboom. So as Black Rock City grew bigger, the man needed to be taller for everyone to see. So instead of increasing his size, he was elevated on top of structures, platforms such as this. These are dust devils that are spin off from the intense heat of Burning Man. And here we have the Temple of Honor in 2003 going up in flames to mark the close of the event. Well, not exactly Pegasus, but maybe Pegaroo. So we have an electroluminescent wire kangaroo piece, and a lightning bolt generated by Dr. Megavolt. And with this, I'm going to read you the epilogue by Lawrence Ferlinghetti, From a Far Rockaway of the Heart, number 97. But what is that laughter under the hill? It's the laughter of the marvelous, of the invisible, of the absurd. Since there isn't any longer any away, on the island further south there's a Club Med. We seek the island inside us, an island in the sun, a wild calypso place, an isle of last escape, the land that is unconquerable, that cannot be consumed. There is a passionate yearning, a longing for wildness, a love of wildness at the heart of every history. From Caliban to Gauguin, from Rousseau's Noble Savage to Rambo's Drunken Boat, and Whitman's first barbaric yelp. From Roanoke colonists who disappeared into the wilderness, leaving a note behind, gone to Croatoan. To London's Call of the Wild, to Kerouac's Cassidy, whose hot rod was his horse. And Ken Kesey in his bus with sign reading further on the last frontier. It is land of heretics and witches, runaway slaves and mountain men, burning men and poet Maudit. We hear their high laughter, we hear their high keening, here at the end of the world. And Black Rock Desert is named after this peak located at the northeastern edge of the playa. And the desert was once part of the Applegate-Lassen Emigrant Trail into Oregon and California. So dreamers in search of new land. And that does it for PowerPoint. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you so much. I believe now we're going to go into a nice Q&A. I'm not sure. Do we have cards, or can people ask questions on their own? Nicole? Oh, people can come to the microphones over here if they have questions. I also just want to give you one observation, which is one that we really were excited to work with Barb on this because she's what they call an old-timer. And we felt that this book would really reflect the vision of Burning Man accurately. I know it's important to Larry, and that the Burning Man community would feel that this was an authentic book. I've been there. I was there in the early years, and I hope I contributed. But it really is Barb's vision, and we're very excited about that. One other thing I wanted to say about Burning Man is that when people come back, and I'm sure there are a lot of you who have been there, but for people who haven't, one thing that always struck me, when people come back from the desert, they don't wash their cars for a very long time. And I think it's because they still want to wear the dream. They want to wear the desert. They want to wear the experience they've just left. They don't want to forget. And that's what this book is about. This book is about memory and magic. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Barb and to Larry. Thank you very much.
Anything you want.
Larry, can you pull the microphone? Larry, can you pull the microphone closer?
Yeah. Yeah. There's no such thing as Burning Man gear. You know? There's not.
My question again, I'm sure you've been asked this before. What was your inspiration? Why did you do it? Was it something like a statement you were kind of making, or was it something that you felt inside that you wanted to share with everybody? Just give us a little insight as to why you started this whole.
Well, there's a short answer to that, and then there's a very long answer that I won't burden you with. A lot led up to it. You know, I was in the middle of a midlife crisis, and I'd been hanging out with a group of carpenters. I called them the latte carpenters. Among them, one man was writing a novel, another was a painter, musicians. You see that in San Francisco. And it gave me the idea that you could just do stuff. I mean, you didn't need to ask permission. And then one day, on the summer solstice, I called one of them, a good friend of mine, Jerry James. And on that spontaneous impulse, we went down to the beach. And the interesting fact is that for the first 3 years of doing this, finally it grew into an elaborate... In order to accomplish the work, we formed a community. And that happened organically without... of itself without too much premeditation. And for the first three Well, for that entire period, in fact, these carpenters, who were all intelligent, educated people, never asked me what it meant. They never asked me why we were doing it. But think for a moment. We at that point had grown to its present stature, and it was as large as a house. It was built with by the same technology that you'd build a house. These men had spent their working lives building houses. They'd sweated over it. On a few occasions, they bled onto it. We carried it down in dismembered form. It took an entire crew to get the leg down. And they didn't have to ask. And at that point, it was them. It was what everything they brought to it. And that's the best symbolism of all. And that's all I'll say about that.
Are there any other questions?
Yeah, I have a question. I'm just curious. You bring 30,000 people to the desert. It can't all be spontaneous. I mean, you must have some medical facilities.
Wait, hold on.
We're recording the program. So
oh, bring it over to the microphone.
Okay, yeah.
I'm
just curious about the relationship between infrastructure and spontaneity. I guess, can you just bring 30,000 people to the desert without any organization, or is there a lot that goes into providing water and services to people when they arrive?
No, you can't just bring 40,000 people to the desert. Well, you can, but then you'd be well advised to have them sign waivers and then run away. We have an emergency response time of about 4 minutes. That's better than any town I know, and we're proud of it. What we have, you can have both. You can have your cake and you can eat it too. I never understood that phrase. If you have the cake, aren't you going to eat it? what possible good is it if you don't? But in any case, It's our intention, first unconsciously held, and then elaborated as a philosophy, as a very meditative philosophy. It's our job as organizers to create a social infrastructure, and we go beyond the obvious things, which is, of course, organized streets, so that if you have to rescue someone, you'll know where they live. Or we have our own fire department and so forth. But beyond that, we've organized the city only up to the point that people are in a kind of relationship to one another where their hearts are open. They, for a variety of reasons, are trying to survive together in hurricane force winds at times, and that'll open your heart to your fellow man. And then they've been given permission to express themselves, and that is the form that takes. It's not been dictated. We don't allow hate speech, and you can't have sex in the road. But then you probably shouldn't. So it gives people this vast permission, and our philosophy, as it has emerged, is that we will organize up to the point where people begin to interact and create culture together, and then we won't cross that border into what they do. Culture is, no one ever planned a culture any more than anyone ever planned a tree or anything in nature. Culture happens spontaneously as nature just happens. It's incredibly ordered if you, as a cultural historian, you start to look at it, but it's not planned. An order emerges out of these interactions, which is very like order in the natural world. And so our notion was that in a greater society, this gets back to my midlife crisis, where when I started this, I saw people getting less literate. People, I saw the general slide of culture into consumerism. Born in 48, and it started to slide, and it's been sliding ever since. And there's less and less culture and more consumption. And so we wanted to create a situation. Nothing can be bought or sold in Black Rock City. We took commerce out of it, not because we hate commerce. You'd have to be it's idiotic to hate commerce. It's a civilization. But we said we want to create an environment which people will relate to one another in a certain way, in which values form and creativity simultaneously begins to order the world. So that's the relationship between the planning part and the spontaneous part. And there's no reason that the two can't coexist, and there's no reason, and ideally the two should reinforce one another. And when they don't in a society, something's wrong. And does that answer your question? Oh, you know, we've never banned political speech, but there isn't a lot because ideology, you know, the stuff they work themselves up about on TV and so forth, it seems somewhat inappropriate in the midst of this tide of immediate experience. You know, even, you know, the crank is you know, for a moment, let's go of his or her hobby horse, you know, and because it seems relevant.
Hi there. I've gone to Burning Man twice. My wife went last year, and she got very upset because she said to me, "How did we not know about this sooner?" Larry, I just got to say that I think...
Was that your responsibility?
I do think of you as a cultural George Washington. You have created an opportunity, a moment in time that is regenerating to people that go there, that grow from there, that connect from there. And it is it's beautiful how much generosity people have of their spirit that come there. In terms of problems, I feel safer there than probably anywhere else in the world. But in any case, my question, and the thing I wanted to talk with you about, this last year I was very pleased to watch with my 12-year-old son Malcolm in the Middle, which had an episode of going to Burning Man, as well as a cartoon which my son and I also like called American Dad, a very clever satirical cartoon where they also went to Burning Man. I'm sure you saw those.
I saw one. I didn't see the other.
Oh. You saw Malcolm in the Middle episode then?
I'm a viewer of Malcolm in the Middle.
Okay, yeah. Okay. Well, American Dad had a very clever episode as well. I just was curious what your response was. I do need to say that I'm really glad this book has come out because there has not been public information except in occasional newspaper or magazine stories, but no real books. Robert Hendrickson has done that great video, which I've seen, but I'm really glad a book has come out. So any comment about how you're being portrayed in the media?
Oh, quite well. I mean, you saw that shot of Media Mecca. But what we did, and I'll give credit where it's due, Marion Goodell, who was in charge of this, she's one of our board members, they began to tell reporters, of course, the First Amendment prevents us from it, and we would never interfere with anybody saying anything. But pictures are another thing as intellectual property, and we've used that, but for a benign purpose. Not to sell images and make a lot of money, really, but it gave us enough authority in dealing with the media to say, to them, when they said, "Well, okay, we want to come in the day before the burn. We talk to Larry, get some shots, good stuff, and get out." And she'd say, "No, you're not. If you're not going to get any shots if you're going to do that, and
do you have a 2-night minimum or a 2-drink minimum?
Oh, it's more. She said you come and you live there, and in doing that, she liberated reporters because they got into it. I like reporters because they're interested and interesting, but as is so often the quandary of people's professional lives is that they started out of a sense of vocation because they loved what they could do well, and they loved the exercise of their gift, and then suddenly they're working for some person they're renting their talents to somebody who doesn't even appreciate what they do, because that's why they hired them. And journalistic practice very often murders curiosity. If you have to get in and get out, and the editor's telling you, you know, write for our demographic, and we've got a sponsor, and something zingy, and do it fast. Well, that's superficial. That's not news. And so we'd make them go back to their editor and say, the producer, and say, well, you know, they won't let us come unless we get a, you know, it looks like we're going to need an RV and have to stay there for a week. Well, how did they stay there for a week? They do the stories of Nightline did a wonderful piece years ago. And at the end of the event, and it was a year when we wanted press because we were having some political difficulties locally. And at the very end of the event, Princess Di died. And that just swept it off. They didn't. Everything was about Di for, you know, a few weeks. But they went back to the producer and they said, we insist that you show this. We don't care if it's out of the news cycle. This is the best work we've done. And they'd showed it. So we don't tell them what to say, but we ask them to live with us. And there's no way you can avoid that if you're there for 8 days, especially if it's your duty to pay attention to what's around you. And at the end of it, they aren't brainwashed. But you know, to be open-minded is not the same thing as being empty-headed. They're full of ideas, and they've seen the real thing. And so they do wonderful reporting anymore. But we have never advertised, to get to your point, which was, why haven't you heard? We've never advertised. It was word of mouth. But isn't that how information travels within communities? Isn't that how values are instilled in larger and larger groups of people? So, you know, we don't waste a lot of time creating propaganda or, you know, advertising of that kind.
You know what is amazing? It's a big Tibetan sand painting that just disappears.
Yeah, it's like that.
That's great.
Yeah, anyway, it's like that.
Thank you.
To speak actually about journalism and or being a photographer at the event, Barb, since you have been there for many years and you stay the length of the event, can you talk a little bit about the challenges of someone who is a photographer who is constantly seeing and recording, but also who wants to experience the event, because that originally is what the event is about, no spectators. Can you talk about the tension that you have to experience when you're trying to create your own art at the same time participate in it? And maybe if you have a photograph you'd like to refer to, I can either punch it up or...
Well, you know, I could be in Black Rock City or Manhattan or San Francisco, and really it's a combination of my aesthetics, the way I see things. And Burning Man, I think, is called me as much as I felt compelled to go to it. It's sort of like your destiny calling kind of thing. And being out there, you're dealing with a lot of elements. I mean, I've already been asked a few times, how do I keep my cameras from breaking down? So yes, there's a lot of that that goes on, but really it's about being in the moment, being inspired, and I've certainly felt that out at Burning Man for a number of years. And I think my style is a combination of the street photography aesthetic, like coming from Robert Frank and Joseph Kudelka and Cartier-Bresson's Decisive Moment, combined with a more abstract, surrealistic sensibility, maybe a more composed, formalist approach. So it's really the meshing of those two ideas. And it's always been a personal journey for me, and sometimes the most personal things are the most universal. So it's pretty much defined my life since I've been out here, and it's very nice to see a long-haul project finally come to fruition.
But how do you decide to involve yourself in the photo? There are various photos where you actually appear either in shadow or reflection or in blur.
Well, that can't really be avoided at certain hours, you know, when the long shadows are cast. But I've always considered myself more than just a voyeur, perhaps a provocateur. So I'm kind of engineering the tableau and becoming a part of the performance in the greater overall scheme of things.
You know, I just thought about it. That's an interesting question because you're in just in the pictures you shown, your shadow appears, your ghost-like movement in front of that storefront mm-hmm. window. You know,
yeah.
You know, it's like Alfred Hitchcock walking through the set. And then it ends. The last picture in the book is great. And why don't you tell them what you did? You just went into the frame and performed.
Yeah, okay. The photo of me in the fashion show, let's see. I made this big box camera and I dragged it up with me on the catwalk like it was this real beast of burden. And so I picked it up. It's very heavy, and I circled and I swung around like I was photographing the audience, those who were watching the fashion show. And then I dropped the box, and I had some postcards from Burning Man from previous years, some of my photographs, and I just tossed them out to the audience. Well, so a friend captured it on film, and that's what ended up being my bio photo. So it really, you know, it's an example of a photographer coming out from behind the camera and getting up there and performing. So, and just as I am sitting here on the stage, trying to articulate my whole experience verbally as a visual artist, which is fine because that's the multimedia world that we're in. So,
but I think that as a photographer, I would say, knowing you for many years, that it becomes part of you, that the active is more proactive. You are dreaming in the experience.
Yeah, that's true. So it's not like I'm just going in and documenting a scene, standing back. It's almost like, you know, somebody said, well, you know, if you're a photographer, it kind of destroys the moment from letting things happen. And yet sometimes I feel it's the photographer who creates the whole moment. So, yeah, this can be a very active situation.
We have one more question, and then I believe we'll go to the reception.
Hi there. You had a lovely picture of one of David Best's temples. And 2 years ago was the first time that my wife and I went to Burning Man. And to this day, the Temple of Stars that he built is still one of the most incredible structures I've ever experienced, been around, been in. And I was just wondering if either of you could speak to why he's kind of stepped away from building the temples, and if he's planning on doing more, or if he's kind of moved on from that. The Hayes Valley one was also astounding.
It was, yeah. David did a remarkable thing. I don't know if people understand how aberrant it is in the context of the contemporary art world. He created a community of people who built a temple. He and his wife Maggie, they're both very good friends of mine, and they would have feasts at their lovely home in Petaluma, and they welded those people together in a very heartfelt way. And finally, he reached a point. I'll tell you the personal story. We were both in Ann Arbor giving lectures at the university there. And we'd met with a group of there are community groups attached to Burning Man all over the world, and there are 40 people lined up right now waiting to be regional contacts, and we met with one such group. They mostly came from Detroit, and David got to talking with them, and pretty soon they were fomenting plans right there to use auto parts in Detroit, in the center of the Rust Belt, to build a temple. And said he wanted to call it the Temple of the Black Jesus. Well, that would certainly get attention. And when that would force them to lead them to go into another community and make contact with it, which is very much the spirit of the event, if you look beyond appearances. And we came back from that and sat in my hotel room for, an hour. It was late at night, talking about it. And David had a joke he told. David is very mischievous. And for years, he would take me apart, especially if there were people running around and around us. And then he'd wait, and then he'd take me apart, and he'd say in low tones, you know, we're both charlatans. You know that, don't you? And which was funny. But sitting face to face with him, he was sitting on this other twin hotel room bed. And I said, you know, David, sometimes the charlatan can turn into a shaman. If I'm not mistaken, that's what you've done with your work. And as our conversation developed, we both realized, he's a little my senior, not too much. I'm 58. That we were both entering the third act of life. And that's the crucial third act that tells you whether the drama was merely glib and clever and entertaining or if it meant something. That's the denouement. And it was our third act. And so what he's done and what I am increasingly doing, we've got wonderful staff, and I do creative things, and I have an executive role in the management structure, and I'm still very much engaged with it, but by degrees I'm disengaging. And to go out into this greater community we've created, because that makes what we've done a lot more meaningful. And David did the most. David has begun to do the same thing. He's going to Detroit. He's going to Seattle. And he did what no artist in the contemporary art world would normally do. Here, this man has built up this body of work that's famous. It was like a new career for him in many ways. He was very well known and collected and for his art cars previously and in other phases of his creative life. But here he's built up this following, and it's been pictured countless times in the media, and then he gave it away. Well, what agent would tell you to do that? I mean, you've got a branded article here. You're giving it away? I mean, what's that going to do to its value in dollars and cents? And what he'd done is he identified a newcomer, a guy who had come just that year, and he saw that he had the spirit, he saw that he had the talent, he saw that he had leadership potential, and that he could substitute, you know, for David, and which were big hard shoes to fill, but the temple was magnificent the following year, and David behaved with absolute equanimity. He Burning Man is about giving gifts, and David turned that gift that was to the entire community. He in turn gifted it away and let the crew take over and let a new leader take over, and that's what can happen if you take if you take, I'm not against markets, but if you take some of the forces that make us selfish and isolate us from one another, because that is one of the problems we have, you take that away and then miracles like that will happen. It wouldn't have happened anywhere else. There's not a gallery owner, not a curator, not an art administrator that would tell an artist to do such an audacious, almost scandalous thing. And that's it's not that he's disinterested, it's that the third act has come and curtain has rose and let's see what happens next.
Thank you.
Sure.
Well, thank you very much, everybody. We obviously really appreciate your spending time and waiting a little bit. And I'm sure I can potentially speak for Barb and Larry that we hope that you take the book and share it with your friends, because there is something to be said about speaking about what you think the images are and what the experience could be out there, and that might be your gift to them. Thank you very much, Barb and Larry, for coming.
Thank you.
Sharing your work.
Thank you.
Please enjoy the reception.